So, welcome back, everybody. Hope you had some chance to get some of the at least nice weather we're having here in Toronto, and by inference, I hear in New York as well, and wherever you might be, and you've had a nice dinner. We are going to be beginning now our closing our evening session. There'll be two lecture sessions, we'll call them. The first one will be with Dr. David Pelkowitz, and subsequently we'll have our closing session. As the participants who've been to JME before know, whenever we do these conferences, we always take into consideration the mental health aspects of the medical ethics and halachic issues that come up, because they do play hand in hand, and they're really they go simultaneously together. And the truth is, when the difficult questions come down and the chips are down, the community generally turns to really the experts. And Dr. David Pelkowitz is always at the head of that class. So he has been with us for many years at our conference. I know that he is always on call to the greater YU community. And it's a pleasure to have you back with us again, Dr. Pelkowitz. Dr. Pelkowitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration, where he is also the Special Assistant to the President. Dr. Pelkowitz has been serving for over two decades as Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital, part of the NYU School of Medicine, and as Clinical Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at NYU as well at the School of Medicine. He receives his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, and as many of you have known, he has published and lectured extensively. And as I alluded to, he is really the one of the amongst the top experts in terms of the interface of mental health, especially when it deals with community manners and the Jewish community in particular. It's really a great pleasure and an honor once again, Dr. Pelkowitz.
Thank you. Such an honor to be here, but I always look forward to the conference, and this year having to do it from afar is really really difficult. As I'm sure we're all experiencing mixed feelings. It's also nice not to have had to get into a car and drive a long distance. So I have two mixed feelings about it. No conflict in interest, I'm sad to say. And in terms of learning objectives, what I'll be focusing on is some of the risk factors for depression, anxiety, insomnia, and distress, and coping with COVID-19 related stress. And our other objective is to understand the central ingredients associated with resilience in facing the pandemic. And that's what I'll focus on. I'd originally prepared the talk to focus also on what frontline healthcare professionals might be experiencing. And I'll just spend a minute or two on that, but I'll spend most of the time broadening it out. Okay, so just to tell you what's been coming up in the research, there was a very informative paper that was published in JAMA, which looks at a large group of healthcare professionals working with frontline people, physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals. And they found that at some point, especially towards the end of the active part of the pandemic, they found quite high levels of depression. This isn't full-blown depressive disorder, but of depressed feelings in about half, close to half in terms of anxiety, about a third experienced sleep problems, and 72% significant levels of distress. None of this is surprising. And I think that most of the people who were part of this audience can relate to it, even if you're not on the front lines, right? There's a totally normal reaction to an abnormal situation. if we're feeling at times sad, anxious, having some sleep problems. Many people are talking about dreams being much more vivid than usual, having some trouble sleeping through the night, the feeling of unreality, and general feelings of distress mixed with some positive feelings. In terms of some of the positive kinds of experiences that some people are having, and we'll talk about that as well. In terms of that JAMA article that just came out a month or so ago, those at greatest risk for having poor mental health outcomes in the Wuhan province were women, which is consistent with what we usually find in terms of post-traumatic stress reaction, that women have a higher risk for that. Happy to talk about it in the discussion if people have questions about that. Nurses who are not in a position of control over their jobs, meaning nurses who are relatively new in terms of their position, were relatively junior in the medical hierarchy, but in general, those who are closest to the front lines are more likely to have the symptoms I just discussed. And they also found that those within that group, there was a particular difficulty with most people on the front line worrying about family members at home, understandably, and past medical illness or mental health history, especially mental health history of anxiety or depression, being predictive of a problem, of greater risk. Okay, now I'm just going to share with you one last thing specifically on this because I think it's of relevance. I have a daughter who's a psychologist in Cornell and Columbia system, who is co-directing a center for frontline medical professionals in the community, the people who are really at the front lines, and running groups and running also individual sessions, because her specialty is in the area of anxiety and especially in trauma. So that's a genetic trait. She took after her father and his interests as the same faculty appointment I had about 30 something years ago, and I'm still checking my mezuzahs. What could you do? But what she is finding and her team is finding is that now that the storm has passed, there's a lot more optimism. People are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. The storm has passed for now, okay? People are excited that they could spend time with their family. But there's also, she's busier than ever. Her specialized clinic has been some huge multiple. In other words, now that you could breathe a little bit, and now, and I think we're all going to experience this to a certain extent, sometimes maybe even in a positive way, that it's only after the hurricane has passed and we could catch our breath a little bit that it starts to catch up with us in a more intense kind of way. And that's not a bad thing, because it means that maybe we could start to process some of the grief, some of the sadness, some of the meaning making that has to take place at some point. So we'll hopefully be able to talk about that a little bit. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network, which is a wonderful organization on anything having to do with trauma and disaster. They've been doing unbelievable work for the last 30, 40 years in the area. I'm privileged to be, to work on some of their sites. What they learned from SARS in the early 2000s is that in the midst of the crisis, healthcare staff experienced traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, and sleep problems, just exactly what that JAMA article found. And in the longer term, healthcare staff didn't show increased levels of mental health disorders. So it's a wonderful sense of hope that in the long term, people do okay. I'm not saying there isn't some impact left, but and there is some lingering issues, but for the most part, there's a lot to look forward to, and that's an important thing. There's a beautiful medrash, Embracious Rabba, that says, Hakol Bekivui. Heard this from Rabbi Dr. David Fox. Everything has to be dealt with a sense of hope and optimism. And then it says, Geula Bekivui, our ultimate redemption comes through hope. And Yisurin, dealing with difficult, challenging times, also has to be met with hope. And that's exactly what the secular research is showing. Okay. I'm going to now skip ahead and go to, well, you know what? Maybe not. This is actually important stuff. So maybe I will go back to the work of Dr. Price. So Dr. Price, who's a psychologist who specializes in traumatic stress at Penn. So she talks about a general approach in dealing with a time like this is a cognitive behavioral approach that starts with first the power of naming the monster and identifying the adversities. These are the ABCs. Okay, what are some of the adversities? And she finds, like we all know, that when you name the monster and you light up the language centers of the brain, you do much better with whatever stress comes your way. So some of the adversities that she's been finding in terms of frontline people is, you know, the adversity of seeing so many patients at once, the challenges of working outside of my usual role, which many of us are facing in different ways. We're being asked to go beyond our regular kinds of comfort level. And then feeling pulled in different directions. You know, I have to work as mother, as supervisor of Zoom school sessions, whatever job I might have, and as the person who also might be taking care of my husband or my parents. And it's those multiple roles that could become incredibly stressful. And how much bandwidth could a person have? And feeling emotionally isolated from family and support systems if you're at the front line. I was walking in my neighborhood, safe social distance, yesterday on Shabbos. And I bumped into a couple, husband and wife, who were both frontline people. They're both specialists, very much in the front line at some of the most affected hospitals in the New York area. One told me that she had lost 3 people to COVID-19 the day before. And her husband also had experienced an unbelievable level of chronic stress. And what she told me was the people who are having the hardest time are the people who are being asked to go past their regular zone of comfort. They may be people who come out of retirement now, but are a little rusty. It may be people who have been repurposed to be on the front line, but just are requiring much more supervision. And when things go wrong, there aren't the M&M conferences to be able to process what's been happening. There have been uncommon kinds of ongoing stress and challenge to people on the front line. And again, what Dr. Price shows is you identify the adversities, like the ones here, beliefs, what are the untapped thoughts that you're silently having about the adversity that you choose to focus on? Because like the Baal Shem Tov told us, B'makom shemachshavto shel adam shamhu nimtza ha'esh. You want to know where the person is? Look at where his or her thoughts are. That's where we live. So to the extent that you could cue into those thoughts and challenge them and bring them into a more productive place, it's an excellent resilience builder. So the B is beliefs, okay? What are you saying to yourself in private? Are you saying I can't handle the stress? Are you saying I'm ineffective? Are you saying I'm not a good parent, partner, or professional? Are you saying to yourself the situation has no end? And all of this is with an eye on how to dispute these beliefs. We'll get to that in a minute. C is consequences. So consequences are what outcomes and consequences are related to this adversity. Okay. Feelings. How are you feeling? Are you angry? Are you sad? Are you worried? And just sometimes by just identifying this, it could be amazingly helpful. And as I see from, one of the participants, right, the real fear of bringing the virus home to your family. I know so many people, I live in a community that is filled with a very high percentage of physicians who are on the front line in some of the most affected areas in the country. And what I'm hearing is people who, because they come home having been exposed in different ways, they're living in different parts of their home, or they don't even feel safe about going home. Family members who haven't seen each other for quite some time. Okay. And then what do you do when you feel that way? Okay. And then in terms of the bottom line, four steps to reframing. And this is the key. I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about this, but from a different place, I'm going to broaden it to the rest of us, to the people not on the front line, to the regular person all over the world who's dealing with this unprecedented kind of set of challenges. So the steps to reframing, okay, is number one is to accept the uncontrollable, to accept the fact that we always live on a Gesher Tzar mode. We're always living on a narrow bridge. Step two is, to the extent possible, you go from the passive to the active and you focus on the controllable. I remember the day after 9/11, there was a massive get together by the community who were very directly affected by the World Trade Center attacks. And I remember that there was a talk, a big get together by people in Brooklyn who were directly affected, including a whole bunch of Hatzalah members, many of whom had been injured in the World Trade Center attack and miraculously survived, as well as family members who had lost people. And I was privileged to be able to speak there. But the main speaker was Rabbi Tzio Solomon of Lakewood. And his opening line in terms of the key to resilience at times that are sort of beyond our ability to comprehend, like this, he said, the key is, how do you go from passive to active? He uses his metaphor, Kinesher Yar Kino Al Gozolov Yirachi, that we're compared at a time of distress to a baby eagle. Why a baby eagle? All living creatures. Because unlike any other living creature, he says, as Rashi tells us there, the mother eagle hovers over the nest, and the baby eagle has to take an active kind of position of jumping on to his mother's back, because that's going to be the safest place. And then the mother flies up higher than any other living thing, so that if an arrow shoots her, her baby will be safe on her back. But unlike any other living creature, that baby eagle wasn't passive. That baby eagle had to jump up. And that's something that the research is showing us over and over again. So we have to, step two, focus on the controllable. Step three is so important, and it's true of everybody. It's acknowledge your own strengths. Everybody has a fire. Everybody has their own strengths. And the key is, you find your strength. For some of you, it might be in terms of the community organization. It might be in organizing conferences. It might be in organizing chesed or packages. Let me read to you something from my wall, something I've never been able to do at a Jewish medical ethics conference before. But I'll take it there. This is from Rav Kook. Okay, and it goes like this. It's so, and this is my passion in terms of thinking about this third step, because it's so central to resilience. Sarach Shekol, here, you can see it, everybody. There it is. Can you read that? No, you can't. I can't. Sorry about that. Okay. spatially challenged. There was no way that was going to work. Sarah Shikolish, Yedevi Yavin, Shibatok Toho, Dolek Ner. Everybody has to understand that in their inner essence, there's a inner flame. The Ein Nero Shelo Kener Chaveru. Nobody on this call, nobody we know, nobody at all in the community has an identical flame. We all have a flame, meaning a source of uniqueness, and we all have to recognize that. Then he goes on, Tzarech Shekol Ish Yeda V'Yavin, She'olav Lamol Ulegalos Es Ar Haner Barabim. We all have to know that it's our job to work to reveal the light of our uniqueness to the whole community. When we do that, when we help our family do that, and we help our community do that, Lahadliko Liavuka Gdola Lahar Es Kol Ha'olam Kulo, to set the world ablaze with the unique fire of our signature strengths. So that's step three. And then step four is to take that and to use the positive in some way that we could counter some of the understandable and valid ABCs that we started with. Let me go now, okay, by the way, on strengths. What in this situation is within your control? What aspects can you focus on that will improve the situation, help you cope better, help you feel more in your control, help your family and friends? Think back to a time when you dealt with a challenging situation in the past and write down, by the way, when you write and you go from chaos to order through writing, it makes a big difference. And that's the bottom line. Okay, now I'm going to go to the rest of the talk between now and 7:45 when we have questions. I'm going to talk about specific writers and authors and experts in the area of resilience in the time of COVID, who I found incredibly, incredibly helpful to me personally, as well as to the people I'm working with. This is the work of Dr. Susan David, a professor at Harvard Medical School and an expert in the area. And her first point, which is a point that I'm sure we've heard over and over again, and that's give yourself permission to be human, okay? Meaning that to not feel anxious and to not feel at times depressed and overwhelmed is inhuman. The way our bodies work, as we all know, is in the face of danger, we all go into fight or flight. It's just what we do for a living. It's what it's all about, okay? And we have to understand that these are feelings, not facts. We have to be compassionate. And the next point that she makes that's extremely important is the idea that we could use these feelings, the most difficult feelings, as kind of a guidepost towards our Jewish values, in our case, our Jewish values. Okay? So she says that if consumed by panic, here are the steps, okay? Look at these six bullet points. Name it, as I've been saying. Just say, this is how I'm feeling. Just the act of naming something in study after study is anxiety reducing. Then, here's where she becomes more unique in her writings. Ask yourself, what is the function of that emotion? Let's say the emotion is sadness or grief. Okay, that's wonderful. It's a sign that we care. It's a sign that we're human. It's a sign that we're alive. And the sadness might be about personal losses. It might be losses of people we're close to. Or it might be just the loss and the understandable feeling of grief, that the feeling of invulnerability, which all of us have been privileged to going through life with, it's gone. It's shattered. Shattered assumptions about our safety. The real recognition that we're living on this narrow bridge. So grief, instead of fighting it, you accept it. It's a signpost to be care, and then act on it. Okay, I'm feeling sadness. It means I care about some of the losses. Who can I reach out to? Is there somebody in my community who had a loss? Is there somebody in my family who may be having a hard time because they're living alone now? Because they, you know, might have a widow or a widower, or you might have other people who are immunocompromised who are living alone. And just take it to action. Become that baby eagle jumping on the mother eagle. Guilt. We might have guilt about parenting, about losing it with our kids or losing it with our spouse. That's a good value. It means we're connected to our children. And then guilt is not a bad emotion to have at all. It's there's two kinds of guilt. There's characterologic self-blame, when we beat ourselves up. And that's associated with all kinds of bad findings in the research. But there's behavioral self-blame, which is not about a pathological thing. But it's about asking yourself, as the Gemara Brachos Hamad Aleph says, okay, Emira Davara, Yifashresh B'masa. If something bad happens to you, the answer is look into yourself, figure out what do I need to do differently. Even something as trivial as if you reach into your hand to get a quarter and a nickel comes out, or even the most minor kinds of things. And what you need to do here is to figure out a way to take whatever guilt you have about parenting, about your relationships or whatever, and channel it into something active and passive. Okay, so everything here is a signpost towards action that could bring us in consonant with our Jewish values. And then finally, writing. There is so much research that's been done, especially by Dr. Pennebaker. Dr. Pennebaker is a fascinating man. I have two volumes of his work over here where he talks about what he and his students have learned in hundreds of studies about the therapeutic power of writing about bad things. And I won't bore you with all of the specific examples of what he found, but the way he came to it was he worked with Steven Spielberg in the Holocaust Project. And he bore witness to the people in who were survivors who were going over, working with him and working with Steven Spielberg on talking about their experiences during the Holocaust. And he found that as he wrote notes about what they were saying, and as he heard them talk, just the act of writing about painful experiences improved immunological functioning. It improved overall health. It improved mood. It was incredibly therapeutic. And he developed a whole therapeutic technique based on disclosure of things that we have a hard time disclosing. So what Dr. David says, which is very much grounded in Dr. Pennebaker's work, is sit down for a few minutes with a piece of paper, ask yourself, in the midst of this chaos, who do I want to be? What is important to me? Just write. And this very act of putting words to the chaos in our brain and hearts and souls moves us from values as abstract to values as front and center. And that's a very important point here. Now I'm going to get to, I think I'm going to go on to some of the work of Dr. David Rosmarin. Some of you know Dr. Rosmarin. Have you had him here at the conference or... Sure, you've had connections with him. Yeah. So Dr. Rosmarin is professor at Harvard, head of the Center for Psychology and Religion, and an Orthodox guy. And he wrote an article very early on in this pandemic that... many people found very helpful. This is in the Scientific American, almost I think the day after the world went on lockdown. And here's what he says, and it's a very basic kind of thought. We cannot tolerate situations that are uncontrollable and uncertain. In fact, we can't control or predict what will happen next with COVID-19. In reality, Self-quarantine and social distancing can slow but not stop viral contagion. You can expect there to be a waxing and waning course to this. Nobody really knows, but there's at least a chance that's what it seems to be scientific experts are telling us. But ironically, this is the paradox. Once we accept the reality that our sense of certainty and control is an illusion, once we understand and appreciate our inherent vulnerability, then it gives us greater strength and a greater sense of equanimity. It's a very interesting paradox. But it's just, instead of fighting, you ride the wave and you just say, okay, this is the way it is. And you focus, as I was talking about before, you focus on the strengths. You focus on talking to yourself. And then I'm going to go into this in much more detail in our remaining 15 minutes. Okay, here's just some other relevant research. Okay, anytime we have some clarity about our feelings, but more importantly, anytime we're able to take negative feelings and see them as beneficial for achieving goals, or as the Rav would say, as our Soloveitchik would say, anytime you go from a position of goral to a position of yiyud, a position of feeling like a log floating on the river at the mercy of the current, to a position of yiyud, I'm a person of destiny. There's a reason for this. I could even grow from this. When we go to that place of post-traumatic growth, it's life-changing. I mean, Soloveitchik's cousin, Dr. Soloveit, short for Soloveitchik, from Yale University, he's the president of Yale, but had been head of his psychology department. His main area of research that brought him to such a level of incredible academic prominence was about post-traumatic growth. He came up with the exact same concept as his cousin, who he didn't even really know. Talking about, you have to go from feeling like you're a log floating on the river in a passive way to a position of growth. Came up with exactly similar kinds of ideas. But the whole idea is we always have the control to do what the Soloveitchik family is telling us, which is to go from a place of goral, randomness, chaos, to a place of yield and growth. Or as the brilliant Medrash Tehillim tells us, which should be really the big poster for this session. Okay? It says, Ilu nafalti lo kamti. If I didn't fall down, I never would have gotten up. Ilu yashavti b'choshech lo haya orli. If I never sat in the darkness, I never would have appreciated the light. And that's what study after study shows us about the power of being able to see this. You know that in the research review in Lancet on what are predictors of resilience in a time of quarantine and lockdown, what they found from previous quarantines and lockdowns in their meta-analytic reviews during SARS and other similar kinds of pandemics, they found it was a very simple core ingredient to resilience. It's to the extent that you could, instead of seeing yourself as the victim of some horrific out of control thing that means that you're somehow a loser or you're passive, or seeing it through that prism. Instead, if you could see it through the prism of, you know something, this is chesed. What I'm doing here, I'm choosing to really keep to the lockdown and to my social distancing and staying away from older people who might be at risk. The fact that I'm choosing to do that, I'm seeing not only as a choice, but as an act of chesed and as an act of tzedakah. When you do that, it turns out you do much better with quarantine. Your mood ends up improving. Again, at every single level, it's the psychoneuroimmunologic functioning of somebody who does that is actually shows improvement. Okay? So that's that piece. Okay? Let me move on here. Now let's talk about kids. talk a little bit about kids. Maybe we have a little bit of time. I'll talk a little bit about shidduchim. So children are obviously having a particularly hard time. When we did the team that I was part of did the field trials on the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis back in the last iteration of the diagnosis, we asked, one of the questions we asked in the field trials around the country, when's the worst time in life to be traumatized? When's the toughest time? We were kind of surprised at the findings. It turned out that it was preschoolers have the toughest times and adolescents have the toughest times. First of all, let's think about an adolescent. Can you imagine anything more difficult than being an adolescent? Think back to your adolescence. Could you imagine what it would have been like to be locked up in a room, in an apartment, in a house, or wherever it might have been, with your parents and maybe your grandparents and your siblings for weeks and even months at a time, and not being able to go out to hang out with your friends? It's like an unbelievable challenge, okay? Just be empathic, go back to that time. It's an incredibly difficult kind of challenge. That's one part. The other part is preschoolers. They tend to be concrete. They tend to misunderstand things. They tend to blame themselves. And they have a harder time if anybody in their circle, chas v'shalom, dies. They have a much harder time than other people in these two ages. But in general, we're all wired for connection. But for children, this is particularly difficult. Unable to see grandparents. It's heartbreaking when I see some of my grandchildren from a safe social distance, and they're dying to sit on my lap. They're dying to come over and give me a hug. And they're not. They can't. Hopefully soon. Can't wait till that day comes. But feeling stuck wherever you are. How do you talk to your kids about this? It's a process, not an event. Okay. There needs to be separate discussions with your younger children. The best way to talk to your kids about that, begin by asking them what they know. Remember, to be understood, first understand. The most important recommendation, this was clear right after Oklahoma City, almost exactly 50 years ago. Any child and any adult who is exposed in an ongoing way to media after a terror attack, and in this case, after a pandemic, is going to have a much higher risk for post-traumatic stress reaction. It's to the point of fact. The general rule of thumb is you don't allow yourself to watch CNN or Fox or whatever network it might be for more than an hour a day. That's you. And you certainly don't expose your children to it. You try to filter. You can't control what your adolescent does, but talk to them about it. You have to minimize exposure and encourage questions. Validate their feelings. We talked about the power of art and writing and music. Art is making something out of nothing, one resilience expert said. Writing is what we talked about with Pennebaker, okay? And humor is making nothing out of something. But you have to explain to kids that not every respiratory disease is COVID-19. And check back with them as the situation changes, because the situation is constantly changing, especially now, and hopefully we're getting ready for some form of reentry. Okay? And let me just start to come to a couple of core points here before I end. The power of chesed. Every research study on resilience shows that to give children chores, to have them help out with cleaning, to have them help out any way you can, okay, is enormously, enormously therapeutic for us to do chesed, for us to reach out to others, but also to teach our children to help and to use this as an opportunity to do it. Kids have to understand this is temporary. They have to understand the timeline. So kids have a whole different kind of concept of time. And then I'm just going to end with a couple of thoughts. Number one, the power of gratitude. Gratitude, like chesed, is our superpower. To focus on what we have instead of on what we don't have is all important, okay? If we do a simple count your blessing exercise on a Friday night, go around the table this Friday night, okay, Yom Tov night, and you say, come up with a few things from the week that you're grateful for. Come up with something from the week where you were able to do chesed for others or others did chesed for you, and share it with everybody around the table. It's associated with higher levels of immune functioning, higher levels of happiness, improved cardiac functioning, and a number of peer-reviewed articles and very respected respected cardiology journals. Nothing quite as powerful as the power of gratitude. And in terms of, let me come to a couple of concluding thoughts. Power of exercise, extremely important, okay? We all know what it does for not only our cardiovascular system, but what exercise does. Also though, in terms of putting on the network, the default network of our brain. Scientists in the last decade or 10 or 15 years have noticed or have found that when we don't think, the part of our brain that lights up is called the default network. And that's where our most creative ideas come. I was just going on a walk with my wife, and we've been kind of agonizing about how to organize the wedding for my only remaining single child. Thank God he's getting married to a wonderful guy. And all of a sudden we're just walking. She says, I figured out how to do it. And she figured out a whole approach to how to have a wedding of different sizes best based on whether we could have 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, or we originally planned 600, but God had other ideas for us. So it's just, it's the default network. But with Dr. Tal Ben-Shachar, one of the leading experts on resilience at Harvard and at IDC, says, to not exercise is like taking a depressant. He says, it's like literally taking a pill, popping the pill, and it'll make us depressed. We literally have to exercise. And even if you're stuck in a one-room apartment and can't go out, it's equally important still to figure out a way. You download some of the many strength exercises, aerobic exercises you can do within the Dalai Lamas of your home. Let me end with a quick thought on shidduchim. It's tough. I've been hearing from many, many groups. There's certain groups that have been having a very hard time. Parents of children who are serving long prison terms, who are in a sense place of terror about their children being constantly exposed to COVID-19. But there's a Facebook group called Brides of COVID. Sounds like a horror movie. But it's actually a helpful support group. But, you know, there are a lot of people who have to rethink some of the plans they've been having since they were little girls or young guys. But the main idea here is that in terms of dating, I would just recommend that you Google and find a wonderful program that YU Connects had with Revitson Efrat Sabalovsky, the head of YU Connects, with experts like Rabbi Dr. Glatt and his wife Marjorie Glatt, all of whom are active participants, over the years in this conference. And they did a beautiful, beautiful session on how to date and increase emotional intimacy even at a time like this. Very hard to connect when you're walking across the street with the person you're going out with wearing a mask. Maybe easier to do it doing some of the exercises that you'll get by downloading their wonderful talk on why you connect. And they keep putting out great materials on it. And I'll end with a parable. A parable from the Dubna Magid. Parable that I found very helpful in some of the talks I gave after 9/11, and I'll share it with you, even though many of you might have heard it. It's a parable of hope, because remember, the Hebrew word tikva is tied to the word kav, or a rope, meaning we're never dangling alone. We're never alone. We're never alone. We're always connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's there with Imo Anochi Bitzara. He's holding us up, into our community, whether we're spiritual people or not. we're always connected. That rope makes sure that we're not dangling and twisting in the wind. Here's what the Dvnamagen said. He talks about a king that had a crown, and in the center of the crown had a diamond bigger than the Hope Diamond. And this king was an insecure guy. Every night, he'd go to sleep, take the crown off, put it on his nightstand, and felt great knowing that he had the biggest and best in the land. One morning, he wakes up, and he reaches for his crown and goes to put it on. And he sees at the center of the crown, there's the diamond now has a flaw right down the center of the crown. He's totally spooked. He sees it as a horrible omen. So he puts out a call to the kingdom. He says, anybody who can fix this flaw, I'll make wealthier beyond his or her wildest dreams. Jewelers come from all over the world. They can't fix the flaw in the diamond. You know, flaw in the diamond is a flaw in the diamond. You can't fix it. Until a little old Jew comes in and he takes an engraving tool that he now engraves magnificent leaves around the floor that now becomes the trunk of the tree that makes the diamond even more beautiful than it was before. That's what I think we could expect. That's what I think we should be hoped for. Kol b'kivui. Hakol b'kivui. Geula b'kivui. Yisurin b'kivui. That's what we have to constantly hold on to, okay? Our lives might have changed. Our sense of invulnerability might have changed. But we're now living a life that it's always our choice to see the beautiful tree and make the flaw the source of growth and appreciation. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, thank you, Dr.
Pelkowitz. I'm going to open up the chat to some questions while people are thinking about that. Dr. Pelkowitz, do you mind commenting on this? What would you suggest are things to look for, both in terms of the children and reflecting back on parents and ourselves, which might be red flags?
You mean in terms of guilt?
Concerning behaviors.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. So in terms of red flag behaviors in children or in ourselves, here's the question to ask yourself about symptoms of depression, anxiety, or panic. If those symptoms are severe, meaning that they're interfering with our regular functioning in a serious way, persistent, that they're there more days than not, and they, most importantly, they interfere with functioning, with daily functioning, I would definitely see that as a sign that we should that you should at least get a consultation with a mental health professional. Our community is blessed with incredible people, but in general, we're living at a time now where, thanks to Zoom, it's probably a little bit easier to get appointments, and we could probably get appointments with people who would probably be very hard to get appointments with otherwise. At the very least, get a consultation. It may very well get a lot better when we have reentry, but it may not. So it makes sense to do that and ask those three questions.
Okay. Dr. Pelkowitz, just reading on the chat box, in my work with physicians and nurses, there appears to be a second wave worry. As things open up in the community, that's adding to the emotional roller coaster. Could you please offer how to best help them and support them?
Right. Yes. The question is, how do you deal with the waxing and waning course of this, which is so difficult because it's almost cruel that we'll get back to once again reconnecting with our grandchildren. One of the private messages I got was from a colleague who asked me to address some of the real pain of grandparents who, you know, can't see their children, and how are they going to do with reentry where they cherish those who are living with their grandchildren. I'm having an amazing time with a little 2-year-old grandchild who's living with us. And I'm already mourning the possibility that her parents are going to be able to abandon us and go back home to a normal life. You know, I'll check my mezuzahs then. Okay. And I have mixed feelings about it, and it's going to be hard. But the key is, you know what, when you predict something, it sometimes makes it a little easier. I don't have any easy answers on the answer to that roller coaster. The only thing I can tell you is that when in dealing with uncertainty, the three P's can be incredibly helpful. The three P's are predict, plan, and permission. Predict is if you predict ahead of time what might be most difficult if we have to go back into quarantine afterwards. And just thinking about it, talking about it, writing about it, prediction takes us from passive to active, okay? Permission is very important. Give yourself permission to worry about it. Ashrei, the highest level of happiness is tied to the Hebrew word to validate, okay? So when you give yourself permission, that helps with uncertainty. And then plan, come up with a coping plan. You know, that goes with ideas of what we were talking about at the beginning of this talk, where there's all the different approaches using cognitive behavioral therapy and some of the wonderful materials available from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, both for adults and for healthcare providers and for all of us, in terms of approaches to the three P's. Again, predict, plan, and permission.
Dr. Palkowitz, with the new relaxation guidelines that are creeping in slowly, there's going to be obviously an influx towards Minyanim. We have two questions with regards to this. Number one, what do you recommend in terms of trying to communicate effectively to the community to slow it down? And I was wondering if you could also comment on a comment that we heard earlier today about the Yetzer Hara comes with a long white beard. What is this Yetzer Hara now that suddenly is driving people to go to Minyanim and breach laws when they have complete license not to go? It's a mystery to many of us.
Yeah, so first of all, just to let you know, Dr. Rosemary and I talked about before, together with a number of colleagues, has a large ongoing study out of Harvard that's asking, he has expertise in this area in particular, and it's asking the answer to that question in an empirical way. But if I could talk about the Yetzer Hara and the long white beard. I don't know, earlier today in those talks, they talked about Revolvi's brilliant essay in Al Eshur called Al HaFrumkeit. So anybody who has Al Eshur, I think it's in the second volume, he has an essay called Al HaFrumkeit on the topic of being frum. And in it, he brilliantly describes how frumkeit is an instinct like any other instinct. And if it's not channeled properly, it could drive people to do crazy things, okay? And he gives some examples, but it's a fascinating, fascinating piece. And that's, I think, what happens here. People just lose sight of the big picture. First of all, there's unfortunate and unfortunately really fatal contempt for science and failure to recognize science, which has cost so many lives in our community now. It's never been, this conference and everything that it stands for has never been more important now. It's a life-saving kind of force to counter that kind of ignorance and arrogance. But it's also an opportunity for us to be able to take a step back and ask ourselves, you know, what matters? What's important? You know, I think that that's the key to resilience also. So I'd recommend that. But again, I think that it's true, you know, and there's some people who are incredible in fighting this. I've been working a lot with the Aguda and with some Hasidisha groups or members of the most right-wing segments of the community. And they've been complaining to me when I have question and answer periods with them. When I give a talk to them, they're crying to me that we can't control some of our balabata, you know. And they it's not like they're thin out. Sure, there's a subset that are giving mixed messages, but many of them are telling me and quietly calling me and sending me emails about asking for advice. How do I deal with this? So it's complicated, you know.
Thank you. Do we have time for one more question? I'd like to just ask Dr. Pelkowitz, what advice do you have for clinicians attempting to distinguish demoralization from depression?
Oh, that's such a fascinating question. If I'm understanding it correctly, maybe I'm being too concrete here. To me, when I think about depression with a capital D, I think about the DSM-5 criteria for depression and that whole, you know, mix of how it impacts body, mood, and behavior. Demoralization, to me, is speaking more about, I don't know if I want to call it the spiritual or the sort of like what's the struggle we're having maybe with this cognitively or spiritually, or in terms of our systems of meaning and our sense of meaning, how could this happen and how do we understand it? I have a feeling that when you're talking about in that question about demoralization, it's referring to something more specific. But
specifically, you know, refers back to the study you quoted, the symptoms suggest majority of participants experience distress. So just looping back to that comment.
Yeah, so that was the stress on a very global measure of PTSD. And that was in that JAMA study, they had a number of relatively short measures of depression, anxiety, insomnia, and distress. And demoralization, though, I'm not sure exactly what the questioner was referring to. Because that was, I don't think that was in that list. But does that person want to weigh in, or we only have another minute or so?
No, I think we're going to close it, right, Jay?
Yeah, we. Thank you, Dr. Pelkowitz. Really, always a pleasure to hear you, and I want to thank you for taking the time and your insights. And we look forward to being with you live in person, you and your wife. And enjoy the grandchildren. I know exactly what you mean. We got our whole family here too. And it's a nice benefit that we wouldn't have had otherwise. So there is something, you know, special. And of course, we all want it to end. We want to take the good too with it. So thank you very much. And we're going to take a 4.5 minute break.
Thank you very much.
It will be back.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Okay. We're going to start our panel in a few minutes. Everybody can go get a cup of tea this time, maybe, instead of a muffin, a piece of cake, some pretzels or an orange or an apple. And we'll see you in 4 minutes and 40 seconds.